The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. Over the next few weeks, we're going to be bringing you a slightly different set of shows. In what we're daring to call the double bill format, we'll bring you a new interview in each show and pair it with something from our vast and ever-expanding Science Weekly archive. This week, we're going to meet a friend of the podcast, Neil Denny.
So Carl Sagan was probably one of the key figures behind why Little Atoms exist.
He's one of the hosts and founders of the Little Atoms radio show on Resonance FM in London. In May and June this year, though, Neil was on the road across the USA. He set out on a Little Atoms radio show tour, covering more than 6,000 miles in search of rational argument and science. He recorded interviews and wrote a series of regular articles for the Guardian website. One of Neil's most interesting encounters was a visit to some of these scientists at NASA. Given that we're all fans of space and NASA here, we thought we'd pair Neil's interview with our Sony Gold Award-winning program, Sounds of the Space Shuttle, which celebrated the final space shuttle mission last year. First, though, here's Neil Denny. Neil, welcome to the podcast. Can you start by just telling us where this road trip across America took you? Where were your stop-offs?
Okay, so I flew to San Francisco, started in San Francisco, and flew home from Boston 28 days later, and basically went via Los Angeles, Phoenix, Santa Fe, Chicago, Philadelphia, New York, Ithaca, and Boston, and lots of other places in between as well, but those were the major stop-offs. Passed through 17 states in all.
And the idea was to, well, as we called it on the blog post series you did for us, to find rationality in the USA. Is that what you were looking for, or were you secretly looking for irrationality?
No, quite the opposite. I think that initial blog post sort of put the wrong message out there, and it was good. It caused quite a bit of controversy and got the trip quite a bit of publicity. But really, I thought I'd sort of position this as being that there's a perception in the UK or in Europe that America is a place of, you know, religiosity and irrationality, which I think is something that's quite easily dispelled. And so the trip was really to go and highlight loads and loads of great science that's going on. And that's really the main thing that happened. And anyone that's read the blogs will see that there is one particular instance where I go and speak to somebody about what could be termed irrationality, but only one instance. Everything else was really looking at exciting science or the sort of historical legacy of American science.
So what you're saying is it's a media attempt to frame the entire trip from one incorrect sentence.
But basically, it worked quite well. As I said, it got.
That's
it
good.
Got
it's always good. It's always good. Sometimes you need in art, I suppose, to define things by the definition of the complete opposite instead. So let's go through some of the people you saw, and it's a real cast of famous, brilliant scientists and rational actors and people who in this country, if you're someone who listens to Little Atoms, or if you listen to this podcast, or if you're in that world, you'll know about these sorts of people. Great scientists, great rationalists. Tell us about some of the people you really enjoyed meeting.
Well, everybody I met was
that's not the right
really
answer.
Helpful.
You can't say that.
I know, but I have to say it. That's the everybody I met was great, really helpful, really welcoming, and really fun to talk to. But yeah, there's definitely some highlights, and the obvious highlight for me, the entire reason behind me doing Little Atoms and going and doing the trip was my obsession in my 20s with Carl Sagan and Carl Sagan's Cosmos. And so I went to Ithaca, met Andrew Yan, Carl Sagan's widow, went to Carl Sagan's house. And that was something of an amazing pilgrimage. I think that was probably the most memorable interview.
Well, we have luckily got a clip of Andriana, which we'll play in a bit later on. And we'll talk a bit more about Carl Sagan. I mean, I think he's probably the inspiration for a lot of people who listen to these sorts of programs. But why don't we start with a scientist who's very famous in the US, and he's a TV presenter. He's a Brian Cox-like figure over there in terms of being on TV. But maybe people in the UK haven't heard of him so much. His name's Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's an astrophysicist. Tell us about him. Who is he? What does he do?
So Neil deGrasse Tyson is the director of a place called the Hayden Planetarium, which is part of the American Museum of Natural History next to Central Park in New York. An absolutely huge and amazing natural history museum, which actually I spent a day at talking to some of the curators as well. But Neil particularly is of interest because anyone that's familiar with a podcast like Radiolab, for instance, Neil deGrasse Tyson's often a contributor to that. And he is a sort of modern Carl Sagan figure, and not least because they're in the production of a reboot of Cosmos, which is one of the things we talked about. We talked about in the interview.
And it's a reboot written by Seth MacFarlane.
MacFarlane is producing it, basically got the thing off the ground. They've been, and Drew Yan again.
Just to remind people, Seth MacFarlane is the writer of Family Guy and American Dad and those sorts of slightly acerbic middle America sitcom cartoons. I mean, it's a strange combination.
That was an amazing interview. He's got this incredible office and just full of geeky knickknacks and books and things in the Hayden Planetarium, which itself is an incredible place to visit. It's a really great
site. Let's listen to a clip of him. Just introduce it for us.
So, yeah, we'd actually just been talking about my visit to the Creation Museum in Kentucky, and I was able to interview a geologist, a PhD geologist who works for the Creation Museum and is using something called creation science to prove that the Earth is 6,000 years old. And I think we'd been talking just before this clip about the idea of what this trip was supposed to be about, the idea of irrationality in science in America. So I did talk to some of my interviewees about that, and this is a good example of that.
There's always been fundamentalists walking the streets, okay? Right? There's always been. We are a free, at least we still tell ourselves, we're a free, pluralistic country. Mm-hmm. Culturally pluralistic, religiously pluralistic, politically pluralistic. So I don't have a problem with people making creation museums. I have a problem if they believe that's science. There are museums on astrology. There are museums on mythology. There are museums on all kinds of things, on cultural belief systems. I mean, in this museum here, there's a whole area given unto what cultures of the world's believed, right? People believe all kinds of things. It seems to be fundamental to what it is to be human. So that's not even my issue. If you think it's science, then that is the beginning of the end of the role that science plays in the economic health of your country.
And they certainly do believe it's science. I was there to talk about creation science, something like intelligent design. These guys clearly believe that they're doing science as well.
Yeah, they're not. And so that's part of the problem. They don't see it as religion, they see it as science. And there are consequences to that. I'm not going to hit them over the head to tell them no. I will alert them of the consequences of this conduct. The consequences are you will breed an entire generation of people who will not actually know what science is. Mm-hmm. And as a result, they cannot enter the workforce in a way that will innovate tomorrow's economies, because innovations in science and technology are the foundations of economies. It's been the foundation since the Industrial Revolution. To the extent that you do not embrace those discoveries is the extent to which you are not a participant on that frontier. And these same people, I don't know if they realize that we have a bad economy and jobs are going overseas, and I don't think they understand or see the causes and effects of these phenomena. But maybe they one day will. Because while no one wants to die, of course, in America, what's especially true is that no one wants to die poor. The connection between science, technology, engineering, and the health of your economy, it's not an obvious connection, but when it's made, it's an unforgettable connection. And maybe some of that needs to be put into the curriculum.
That was Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's the director of the Hayden Planetarium in New York. A fantastic speaker and someone that I can't ever disagree with. And again, just that demonstrates his magnificent soundbiting. And he's such he's a great raconteur, actually, about this stuff. But why were you talking to him about creationism? I mean, I suppose you'd been to the Creation Museum. And what was the reason for your trip there, given that, as you said at the beginning, it was all about science?
So, yes. Yeah, so there was this idea that this trip was supposed to be about highlighting irrationality in America. And as I said, I don't necessarily agree with that. And the philosophy of Little Atoms, I guess, is that I'm not interested in interviewing people that promote homeopathy or psychics or anything like that. I would rather highlight it from the other way around. So I'd rather say that stuff is wrong by interviewing scientists. So the whole point of the trip was to interview scientists that were doing great work in America. And I interviewed 39 people, and one of them was at the Creation Museum. And the only reason I did it was because they claimed to be doing science. I wasn't going to highlight creationists. I could have interviewed creationists in any church in America. I specifically went to talk to them because there's this thing called creation science that they do. So I thought that was worth highlighting. And then there is this one interview out of a series of probably 35 shows that talks about that. And every other interview that I do virtually is in some way a sort of silent rebuttal to, you know, to their argument.
Let's stick with the science then. Your next interview that you brought along to play is a world famous geneticist, and you can call him a philosopher if you like in some respects, in the way that he is able to see beyond just his own science. Tell us who he is.
So this is George Church. He's a geneticist currently at Harvard Medical School, and is, as you just highlighted, an absolute towering figure behind genetics, and he's a tinkerer and an inventor. And not only was he central to the Human Genome Project, which we talk a little bit in the clip you're about to play, but he's invented and sort of made better sequencing machines. And, you know, he's really key in the development of the technology as well.
And he looks a bit like Father Christmas.
This is absolutely true. He does. He's got a fantastic bit, which I'm very jealous of.
Well, let's have a listen to him.
The Human Genome Project, I would say, originated in 1984 when we were tasked by the Department of Energy, we being a small group of about 10 scientists, to estimate mutation rates of human beings exposed to various hazards resulting from the energy industry. Mm-hmm. This could be chemicals, could be radiation, it could be other energy sources that were of unknown mutagenicity to humans. Mm-hmm. Now, in principle, you could measure mutation rates in animals or bacteria and then extrapolate to humans, but they wanted to actually do it in humans. So this was in Alta, Utah in 1984, and we concluded within the first few minutes that this was well beyond our capabilities to speculate on even, right? And so we said, well, what are we going to do the remaining 3 days? We could ski, since we were at Alta and there was nice snow. And we did. But it turned out this was the first time that people with these skills had been in the same room. And we had each been kind of converging on the possibility of doing genomics. And in particular of sequencing genomes, or quite a few of us are mapping them. And so we proposed at the end, as a consolation prize or, you know, just something to take home, that we could sequence a genome.
That was George Church there of Harvard Medical School. And he ended there by saying we could sequence a genome. And from the publication of the first draft of the human genome in 2000, now 12 years later, I mean, so many things have been sequenced. Sequencing technology has got amazingly fast and it's getting cheaper all the time. We're on the cusp of personal genomics. I mean, this is a guy who was really at the forefront of something profound in biology. And for you, it must have been quite an interesting experience meeting this guy who you must have heard and read about. And how do you keep your cool in front of people like that? You could ask a million questions to in a sort of, you know, Beatlemania-esque hysteria.
And that particular one was a good example of that because, yeah, he's something of a hero. And I met him in his lab. So before I got to sit in the office with him, I walked all the way through the church labs where there was 20 or 30 people working on. I'd seen that lab on TV, and so it was, yeah, that was quite an exciting one. But he was wonderful and disarming and friendly, and so there was no problem keeping my cool. It was a really, really lovely experience.
You must have wanted to ask him questions for days on end. I mean,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you listen to some of the interviews, some of them are longer than others, and yeah, there are some that just go on and on and could go on for hours.
Did George Church talk about where he thinks the future of genetics and genomics is going, given that he's was there at the, well, near the beginning of a lot of this stuff? Is he confident about, you know, personal genomics, for example? Is he confident that we're going to solve cancer or anything like that?
Yeah, we talked a little bit in the interview about the future, but I mean, specifically, you just mentioned personal genomics, and he went on from being a central figure in the Human Genome Project to do something called the Personal Genome Project. He's an evangelist for open source, which is something else I'm interested in. He started this project to basically publish the whole of an individual's genome and put it up on the web. And I also interviewed a guy called Misha Angrist at Duke University in North Carolina, who was one of the participants of that. And people like Steven Pinker, for instance, were also participants in that. So he's very much at the pushing the forefront of personal genomics, yeah.
So the final clip we're going to play is Andrian. She is the widow of Carl Sagan. Neil, why don't you just take us through who Carl Sagan was? For those who maybe haven't heard of him, there aren't going to be that many of our listeners, but just for completeness.
So Carl Sagan was an American astronomer, astrophysicist based out of Cornell University, but he's best known for being the face behind and the writer of Cosmos, a monumental series from the 1970s that basically got so many people that we know interested in science, including myself. So who is he for me personally? He's probably the one of the key figures behind why Little Atoms exists at all. So as I think I mentioned earlier, this going to speak to Andrian was really the key interview of the whole series, because we could talk about, you know, this is why I'm here, this is why I'm in America, this is why I'm here in your house.
And Anne was also one of the writers on Cosmos, mm-hmm. and that's how they met, in fact.
Indeed,
Anne,
yeah.
Andrian and Carl Sagan, their name. Got married, I think, a couple of years afterwards, and that in itself is a beautiful love story. What's Anne going to be telling? What's Anne telling us in this clip?
So we're talking about Voyager, the Voyager projects. They met as part of, they were working on the Voyager project, and Anne specifically was involved in curating on the two Voyager probes. There was a gold disc featuring a number of pieces of music from planet Earth for somebody out there to find billions of years later. And things like, you know, Beethoven and Bach and lots of sort of Chinese and Indian and Native American music and things. And earlier in the trip, I also interviewed Edward Stone, who was the director of JPL, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and was and remains, interestingly, the chief scientist on the Voyager missions. And we talked about how the two Voyager probes are literally now, any day, probably sometime in the next couple of years, but it could happen any day, are about to leave the solar system. They're right out there on the very edge of the solar system. We're still receiving transmissions from them, but at any point they're going to leave. And that is what Annie and I are talking about in this next clip. What I find so profound and romantic about that mission, and this is a crazy thought, they're hunks of metal, but I can't help anthropomorphising them and feeling somehow sad. They're lonely. Those things are out there so far away, on their own, in that vastness.
It's just I understand your feelings, but I have a different feeling, which is, in my bedroom, the opposite wall to my bed, is one of the very rare golden record covers that were produced at that time. One was given to Frank, one to Carl, and to NASA, and then two on the spacecraft itself. So I feel very, it's almost, just, it's a sacred object. I go to sleep looking at this one record cover at night, a golden cover with its scientific symbols, and I think to myself, I am not afraid to die, because I know, I make myself imagine I'm moving with them through the galaxy, leaving the solar system, making for the open sea of interstellar space. And just feel like, well, no matter what happens to me, my greatest happiness and the feelings that made my life most worthwhile, they live.
So that was Anne Druyan, the widow of Carl Sagan, talking about, and then you were talking to her about Voyager 1 and 2. And as you say, they're about to leave the solar system. I've been reading some articles recently about the fact that that's going to happen anytime soon. If you remember in Star Trek, they did find Voyager.
in the first film.
In the first film and turned it into a god, or it becomes sentient. Is that what you're kind of hoping is going to happen from listening to you in that clip? You want those things to be alive.
They're not malignantly alive as they were in that film. I'm sort of slightly embarrassed listening back to that clip, but I genuinely do feel that. It seems of all of the NASA missions with probes, those two, because they're the furthest away, there's something weirdly sort of anthropomorphic about it. They're really lonely. And I think it's also the fact that, as she mentions, might not be in that clip, but we certainly talk about it in the interview, that they've got a shelf life of billions of years. You know, they really genuinely anticipate that billions of years, probably long after life on Earth has disappeared. Well, the Earth might have disappeared. Those things might be picked up by some other civilization. Well,
we'll always basically know that there's a little tiny bit of Earth sort of floating off in space somewhere, and maybe a dead hulk of some sort. But also, it was a Voyager one of the Voyagers that was turned round at some point in its trip to look at the Earth from wherever it was near the edge of the solar system. And Carl Sagan wrote that wonderful paragraph about every king, every battle, every lover that's ever lived.
The famous pale blue dot photograph.
That's right. And I'm actually just talking about it now has made my hairs on the back of my neck prickle up, because it's such a beautiful piece of writing, but also a lovely picture of the sunbeam with a tiny dot in the middle of it. What a couple they must have been. Imagine dinner at their house.
And if you imagine, you know, you say that made the hairs on the back of your neck prick up, and he would keep pointing to chairs and saying, "That's where Carl sat when he was writing Cosmos. That's where Carl sat when he was writing Contact." Oh, and yeah, that was something of a visit.
I'm surprised you managed to leave that place without melting. well, Neil, it's been really a pleasure to talk to you. Where can people listen to this trip of rationality across the USA? Where can we listen to all these interviews?
So what's happening with these trips? There's going to be about 35 programs. There's about 10 or 11 live at the moment, and they're not going into the normal Little Atoms podcast feed, because that would mean hogging the Little Atoms podcast feed for the next 35 weeks. So search for Little Atoms Road Trip on the internet or on iTunes, and you'll find this series of podcasts.
We'll put a link up as well. It's going to be one a week or something? Or have you,
two a week. There's two a week going up.
And you're just going to dump them out into the world, and hopefully people will join in and send notes. And if you've got, obviously, comments you want to make about the next Little Atoms Road Trip, I'm assuming they can email you, and you can do a sort of creationist tour next time.
This is true, and that can be those comments can come from other civilizations billions of years into the future if they like.
That's right. And Voyager, if you're listening, send a message to Neil. He's worried about you. For more information on how to listen to Little Atoms, a really fantastic show about science and other rational ideas, and if you're a fan of this podcast, you'll love that one, go to littleatoms.com. Neil wasn't the only person moved and inspired by NASA, of course. Last year, The Guardian's Ian Sample interviewed two veteran astronauts, Piers Sellers and Scott Altman, ahead of the final space shuttle mission, the launch of Atlantis on mission STS-135. Along with our photo galleries, articles and videos, all of which, by the way, are still online to be viewed, producer Jason Phipps created a special edition of Science Weekly to mark the occasion, using a blend of Ian's interviews, original music and sound effects. Indeed, it was so well received that it won the 2012 Gold in the Sony Radio Awards in the Best Internet Programme category. So, sit back, close your eyes and enjoy.
Joined on the flight deck by pilot Mark Kelly, flight engineer Lisa Nowak, and mission specialist Mike Fossum. Mission specialist Piers Sellers headed for 6 months on the International Space Station.
Okay, well, actually, I'll rewind a little bit. We get a special government breakfast, anything you like. I always had steak and eggs because that's what the Apollo astronauts had. I thought it was required. And then after that, quick cleanup, and then you go into the suit-up room and get into your orange pressure suits and load up with all your gear for that. And that's kind of fun because you get to sit in the same room where they suited up the Gemini and Apollo guys and all the shuttle guys before you. So the room has some history. Walk out, downstairs, down the elevator, into the van, and then the van with little convoy trundles out, you know, the few miles to the pad. You go past all the... It is kind of a morale boost because you go past all the shuttle engineers and techs who are waving and stuff like that on the way. But there are fewer and fewer people as you get out to the pad. And by the time you get out there, there's just the actual pad rats, you know, the crews that work the vehicle. Up the elevator, up to the 195-foot level, and now it's just you and a few people in white suits who are there to load you into the machine. And you stand around on the platform waiting. And there are two things to do while you're waiting. One is there's a handset, a phone there, so you can phone people if you're one of the last people to be loaded on board. And two, there is a old prison toilet nailed to a piece of plywood up on that level, so you can go and use that. Probably a good idea. Now, while all this is going on, the world is swinging around, you know, the world is rotating, and at some perfect moment, the world swings around so the launch pad is pretty much underneath the flight path of the space station. And that's the moment you want to go. That's the target time and place that you want to hit to the minute to get off the planet. You have the feeling of going faster and faster and faster. You're being mashed back in your seat by the acceleration. And the instruments are unwinding, you know, in front of you, and you can see the speed building up. After about 45 seconds, you get the call that the main engine's going to throttle down so that the shuttle will ease through the transonic region. And you watch the thrust fall down on the instruments. And then you're aware that you're going supersonic about 1 minute after you launched. But you're going supersonic straight up, you know, not along, straight up. And you are zipping along. At some point, you see the sky just go from blue very quickly to black as you puncture out of the atmosphere. You keep hammering along like this at first stage for the first 2 minutes. Everything's a lot of vibration, a lot of, you know, rattling and rolling in the cockpit until you get about 2 minutes. Then the solid rocket boosters, the thrust tails off, and there's a huge bang and a flash, and those puppets fall off.
Everything looking good on the Bird. Solid rocket booster separation confirmed, guidance now converging. Onboard computers commanding the main engine nozzles to swivel, aiming the shuttle for its precise target in space for main engine cutoff.
Hammering along at Mach 3, 25,000 feet per second or so, and you watch the counter come down. There's a little arrow that moves from right to left on the instrument in front of you. The clock's down the last 10 seconds before main engine cutoff, MECO. And at that second, you hear a bang. Engines cut off. And you go from 3G to 0G in a fraction of a second. So from being shoved back in your seat and not really able to move at all, to you floating forward and bouncing around your straps and everything else in the cockpit that's sort of unrestrained starts floating around too. And there you are in zero G, scooting around above the Earth. It happens instantaneously, and you're ready for it, but it's still always a bit of a surprise, and everyone's laughing at that point. It's such fun. Yeah, we have a sort of a plan to get us through the first day. Basically, get out of your suits, hang all those guys up, get comfortable, then convert the shuttle from being a rocket into being a spacecraft, putting out computers, moving bags around, stuff like that. That takes actually longer than you'd think. It takes about 4 or 5 hours. The next day, you catch up with space station, and the day after that, you dock. And that's exciting. You slowly sneak up on it, and the space station goes from being a very distant star when you can first see it to a brighter and brighter light, and then eventually this gigantic, full of shining silver structure that's hanging there in the black sky above you. You sneak up below it, and then at the appropriate moment, the shuttle does a complete, you know, the pitch around move maneuver, where the shuttle does a loop effectively 600 feet below the station. So the guys on station can photograph the belly of the shuttle to see if there's been any damage and send all that digital data back to the ground. So you do that, and then you come up level with the station and slowly kind of ease yourself in towards it. It's a bit like, you know, a very delicate parking job. So the idea is to basically match up velocities so that you dock at about 1 inch per second when you finally come in.
Morning. Flight day 8, and Tracy and I are going to do a little bit of robotics here to move the pallet.
It's cramped, but very functional. You know, the designers put a lot of thought and effort into trying to make this place as efficient a workplace as possible. The extraordinary thing is, particularly this when you're spacewalking, is that sometimes it looks like you'd expect it to look, which is you're flying over a gigantic blue rotating ball with a black sky, and it's breathtakingly beautiful. But other times, your perception can play some tricks on you. Quite often, you feel that the world is like a big wall on one side of you, and you're flying sort of horizontally around it. So this big curving blue wall that goes above your head and below your feet, and you're scooting around the side of it in a long arc. And other times it's like a big ball above you and you're going underneath it. So the orientation changes a little bit. It's so bright. When you look at the world, it's incredibly bright. The blue, the seas, you know, the oceans, they look like blue neon. They're so bright. It hurts your eyes. Clouds are very bright. You can see everything on the continents. You can see the rivers, the mountains, forests, cities, all sorts of things. A tremendous amount of detail. Even big fields. You can see big fields if you look carefully. So, great view, and you get to go around the world every 100 minutes and so see a new piece every time.
Scott Altman, our commander, who flew the space shuttle in formation with the telescope, going how fast?
17,500 miles an hour.
Very fast. Formation. Very, very fast.
Well, so like for Ascent, you're kind of just being thrown back. We got the capability to take over and hand fly it if we need to. And then on orbit, it flies totally different than anything because you're floating and you're using your control systems in a different way. On entry, coming back to land, when we get back in the atmosphere and the commander actually takes over and hand flies it, it is a big vehicle and you are coming down like a brick, but it actually feels relatively crisp, especially in roll. I was very pleased with how it responded to my inputs and how much easier in a way it was to handle than the simulations we'd done both on the ground and in the air in the shuttle training aircraft. I thought the shuttle itself flew better than all of the sims.
Then on entry day, you get up early, and it's a sprint. You know, you have to pack away everything, secure everything, get in your pressure suits, everyone's sitting in their places. And the whole business really starts at the deorbit burn. So you turn the shuttle so the tail's pointing into the wind, if you like, let rip with the engines for a long burn to kick the shuttle out of orbit, then flip the shuttle over so its nose is now pointing in the wind, it's pointing the right way for hitting the atmosphere. And very quickly after that, you start descending into the upper layers of the atmosphere. You don't see much to start with, but after a while, you get this beautiful cherry red glow all around the shuttle, and you can see it snapping over the tail. It kind of pulses. But over the forward cockpit windows, it's just a beautiful cherry red that you can see through. In daylight, you can see through this red haze and see the world.
As you go a little lower and a little further, you start to notice it changing to a little bit darker, kind of into the yellows. And as I'm sitting up there in my pilot seat on my second entry, I was looking out at that and I started to see it get a little bit darker. So I floated up in my seat a little bit and looked towards the nose, and I could see it transitioning from yellow to kind of pink. And I floated up a little higher, and it was starting to go red. I was like, ooh, I don't know if I want to look anymore. So I floated back down in my seat because it just looked too hot, too brutal out there.
And then what's even more remarkable is you're scooting along and you're going very, very fast and relatively low down in the atmosphere. So you see cloud tops just whipping by you as the shuttle decelerates over the Pacific Ocean. You know, does a couple of big S turns to slow down over the Pacific Ocean.
You know from the moment you do your final deorbit burn, and you're about 12,000 miles away from your landing point at that point. But once you slow down that little bit, one thing you know for certain is that in about an hour, the shuttle is going to hit the surface of the Earth. The challenge to you as a commander and the pilot is to make sure that where you hit the Earth has a runway underneath it.
Atlantis Houston, on energy approaching the hack.
Deploy. Copy them. I'll drag ship deploy, and my covers are all open.
Same here.
Say 1.1 Mach.
Comes the rock road.
You really don't have any sense of gravity yet as you do your burn. You're just almost imperceptibly slowing down. But as you go through the entry a little bit, you'll go to put a card, hang a card on a Velcro spot or something like that, and you let go of it, and you notice it kind of slowly floats to the ground, to the floor. And you're like, wow, look at that. And you do it again. Hey, gravity. We haven't seen that in 2 weeks. And it's amazing, you know, your perspective has changed.
Coming up on 2,000 feet, pre-flare decks. And a pre-flare arm to gear, please.
Your gear is armed, you got a light. Looking good on your lineup.
Angle of ascent is about 30 degrees. In an airliner, it's about 3 degrees. So in an airliner, you think you're coming down and pointed sort of at the dirt, you know, that's only 3 degrees. 30 degrees, when you look out the window, it almost looks like you're coming straight down, like a lawn dart, straight at the earth, straight at the world. I mean, the world is swimming up towards you incredibly fast.
50 feet. Looking good. 20, 230, 15.
The nose is pointed at the ground, and you know you don't pull up until 2,000 feet, and then you start slowly pulling the nose up, slowing your descent rate, and giving up airspeed to slow that descent rate, targeting a smooth touchdown about 2,500 feet down the runway.
2,000 feet. Commander Scott Altman beginning to flare out the vehicle, pitch the nose up as he approaches runway 22 from the northeast. 300 feet, landing gear down. Main gear touchdown. Nose gear touchdown. Space Shuttle Atlantis is rolling out on runway 22 at Edwards Air Force Base, completing 197.
Well, it is an incredible vehicle. I worked on the next generation vehicle that we were trying to build for exploration purposes after I got back, before this last mission and after it. And I started looking at all the design compromises that have to be made when you're building a new vehicle. And with that knowledge, I look back at the shuttle, and I'm just amazed and thankful to the people who built it at all the capability they built into that vehicle to be able to do so many different things over the life of the shuttle program in 30 years, from expanding basic science to using it as a construction truck for building the space station. It's been a very versatile vehicle. You know, I'll remember the accidents, but I'll also remember the four times the shuttle took me up and brought me back safely. So they're incredible vehicles. I'm going to miss them.
They're real ships with their individual characters and their own nicks and bumps. You know, you look at the shuttle, it's not like this. When you get inside it and look at the outside, it's not like it's this pristine, shining, gleaming piece of metallic sort of technology. It's not like that at all. It looks like a ship. It's got sort of dents and burns, and inside it's got, you know, multiple crews of whack the paintwork, and you can see scratches and things. So they're ships that have been operated and lived in and done these incredible voyages, all with their individual characters. I'm personally very fond of the shuttle. And when they wind up in museums, I'll go and see them. I'll go and see them, and I'll be happy to see them. Old friend.
That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time, of course, on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.